kick off our series called Women Being Myers, Women's Health Care Careers. And I have a few housekeeping announcements, not to be gendered. First of all, there are people here who wanted to record this program, and I thought the rest of you ought to know about it, so keep it clean. Second, if you haven't already, please be sure to put your name in the bowl. Write it on a piece of paper, put it in the bowl. There will be a raffle afterwards, and I'm sure you can't guess what the prize might be. If you are joining us by phone, thank you for joining us today. And thank you also to Trish Dolan, right here, and Karen Jamaica, is that the way to say it?
Jamaica.
Okay. Christine Brennan and Carmen Lutz, who saved us from ourselves by setting up the telecom.
Thank you.
Others who are near the phone, please chew quietly. I would like to introduce briefly my co-chair, Cheryl Lloyd. Where are you? There's Cheryl. And my co-chair, Stella Nye. Actually co-vice chairs. Catherine Montano, our recording secretary. And Rosemary Changston, who is our treasurer. She's got the money over our Stella and Rosemary are responsible for pulling the event together today. So very grateful to them. And now it is my very, very great pleasure to introduce our very own Larry Krogan, who is a member of our committee. Hold on, I've got information. Mary is a professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at UCSF. She's been there since 1987 in that position. She received her PhD in epidemiology from the Johns Hopkins University School of Hygiene and Public Health, and her bachelor's degree from UC Davis in 1982 in community health. Go Aggie! And as you know, she's currently chair of the Academic Council.
I was going to stand up, but yeah, I'll just ask if you want to shift a little bit, Karen. I'll stand over here. My energy level is better because I'm used to lecturing in large lecture rooms. So believe me, you don't want me sitting. So as Susan said, my UC career really started when I started as a freshman at UC Davis in the fall of 1977, only to be followed 3 weeks later with my first Chem 1A midterm. Where they did not add up my points correctly on the midterm, so I had a 65 instead of an 85. They missed an entire 20 points on one page. And so being the freshman pre-med that I was, I went to his office to get it recalculated. And after arguing with me for 10 minutes that pre-meds were always gunning for A's and getting more points, and he had a policy not to do that, and by the way, girls shouldn't be in chemistry anyway. So I was really not the person to make that statement to. I walked out of his office, went to get on my bike, and I was just about to ride home, and I thought, I actually won't use the words I thought, people are recording it. So I turned left instead and went to Murat Hall, which is where the chancellor's office is. So, you know, I actually didn't occur to me to go to his department chair or something else that I would now know would be the next step. But I just went all the way up, and I ended up in the dean of the College of Letters and Science. And by then, was pretty ticked off and crying. And I stood in front of the secretary and said, I didn't need to meet with somebody. This professor won't re-add my exam, and I'm down 20 points and all that. And she's like, no problem, we'll make an appointment for you. He's filled today, but I think we can squeeze you in tomorrow. Now, number one, you're talking about a dean meeting with a freshman over 20 points on their exam, right? That's a pretty remarkable thing. But the more remarkable next step was the door to the dean's office was about 20 feet away, and I heard this, why don't you send her in right now? And I walked in and I sat down and he handed me a box of Kleenex and he asked me what had happened. And I explained to him and he said, well, we just can't let this be. Here are some suggestions. He publicly apologizes to the entire class for his attitude towards women in chemistry. He sends you a letter of apology, personally written, and I place something in his personnel file that's a disciplinary action for this statement. You can have all those three, and you can have anything else you come up with. I had not thought of needing to know the three. I just really wanted my 20 points. So I turned to him and said, you know, I'd really just like my exam regraded. That would be the only thing, and your three options sound great. So the next day in lecture, he makes a public apology to the girls. He's probably offended in chemistry, but at least he did it. I do have a certified letter delivered to my apartment that next afternoon. And he did have something placed in his personnel file. Now, this story goes full circle because I went into working on sexual harassment and discrimination policies for probably 20 years in the University of California. But having had this brilliant example of the best way it could have possibly have been handled in my first months as a UC student. But the irony is the professor died about 6 weeks ago. And the chair of the Academic Senate is responsible for sending a memorial to his family members. So in about 3 months, I will have the pleasure of signing a letter that goes to his wife. So here's the irony of it. I will do so, and I will not add a comment pointing out who I am, or that freshman from 32 years ago who got him in trouble for his statements about women. But life does have some ironic twists and turns in it. To finalize that story and finish it up, though, the dean of that College of Letters and Science was named Larry Andrews. What I didn't know at the time was he was a co-researcher, co-author of textbooks, co-authors of publications, and a chemistry department faculty member. He nevertheless took on that strong an action with one of his colleagues and one of his best friends. The next year I was in advanced organic chemistry. Larry Andrews was my professor. He looks up on the first day, calling off roll, and goes, Krogan Mary, which immediately got my attention, because if you pronounce my last name correctly, you know somebody in my immediate family. So he looks up, and he said, Ms. Krogan, it's a pleasure to see you here today. So again, very, very honorable, appropriate way to handle that. My time at Davis was absolutely, from that point on, spectacular. So that's the only adverse event I experienced in my undergraduate career. I had opportunities for internships, for work experience, rotated through hospitals, worked as a paid research assistant for 2 years, and when I finished my biology degree in my junior year, I actually wrote an individual major in community health and was allowed to take a master's program as a fifth-year program in the vet school as an undergraduate studying humans, not animals. So that's a pretty big hook for getting somebody interested in the university when you have that an amazing experience as an undergraduate. And my oldest daughter will actually be attending Davis next year as a freshman. She's been brought to picnic day every year since she was born, so I'm kind of too surprised that was her first day to college. So then I went on to Johns Hopkins. Actually never really experienced issues there personally, except that one of my professors in my first year was an incredible woman named Anna Bacher, who developed the field of occupational medicine, discovered mesothelioma, all the lung diseases related to coal and asbestos and so forth this woman discovered. She'd gotten her MD and her PhD at Johns Hopkins. She received tenure when she was 84 years old. So that was kind of a big deal to me in looking at discriminatory practices against women. Ironically, where things turned around at Johns Hopkins was actually a function of Jack Stobo, who's now here at the Office of the President. Jack was the first department chair to arrive at Johns Hopkins and say, this is untenable. This climate is inappropriate and hostile towards women. Grand rounds were switched from 7 a.m. Saturday morning back to Monday through Friday, so that women could attend and not be leaving their children in front of cartoons on Saturday mornings, which, I mean, this is 200 years of tradition at Hopkins to do all the grand rounds. Everybody's required to be there every Saturday morning. So Jack actually is credited as the department chair of the Department of Medicine at Hopkins, who really turned that place around and started to get them to think of it. Of course, he came as I was leaving. So, but I came to San Francisco as a result. So it was coming back home, actually. The way I ended up in San Francisco was the first summer I was at Johns Hopkins, the humidity was just killing me. I'm a California native, so I really wanted to come back to the Bay Area. And the AIDS epidemic had just, this is the summer of 82, the AIDS epidemic had really broken out in San Francisco. And if you weren't a gay male who could serve as an interviewer in the AIDS epidemic, there weren't jobs for people in epidemiology. That was just how it was. As a woman, I was absolutely not employable that summer for anything to do work and research. So I ended up volunteering with Kaiser to do some analysis and medical record reviews. Well, ironically, that volunteer position, which was for 6 weeks in the summer, I worked with Diana Pettini a couple years later. She moved to UCSF and recruited me to UCSF as soon as I completed my degree at Johns Hopkins. So this is one of my other pieces of advice to people. Don't close doors before you've opened them and really taken a chance. Because sometimes the things that aren't the things you think are what you're going to want to do put you on the path that you were trying to get on to begin with. So it was an important aspect of it. So when I came to San Francisco in 1987, Diana had recruited me to run a practice-based research network. They had about 80 physicians associated with the family medicine department who wanted to do research in their practices. And you can think of this as clinical trials or anything of interest to primary care physicians. But my job was to recruit people all over the state and get the studies up and running, which I did for about the next 17 years. Grew it from 80 to over 600. We covered all of Northern California and the Central Valley, studied lead poisoning and Oaxacan immigrants to Salinas and the Monterey Bay Peninsula. What cough medicine should you use, which, by the way, is a double dose of dextromethorphan, not codeine. That's actually, that the paper we published on that is now the standard of care in Europe. You never know where your work's going to go 20 or 30 years later. And we just researched everything that doctors in practice had concerns about and what they brought back to us as concerns. And my job was to facilitate that, get federal funding, keep everything going. I loved the work with the clinicians. It got to be very, very difficult, though, after years and years of doing that, that my own interests were really in infertility, reproductive, and perinatal epidemiology. I was extremely interested in why women had trouble getting pregnant, what that meant for their health, and what that meant for the health of the children that they might have eventually conceived. So while I had all this practice-based research network going on and training doctors in how to do clinical research, I simultaneously had a whole nother level of research going. And for those of you who are not faculty, whatever area you do research in, that means there's those national and international committees. You're on NIH study sections. It meant I was spending about 2 weeks of every month in Washington, D.C. at that point. 1 week a month on practice-based research, 1 week a month on reproductive epi. A colleague and I actually considered taking an apartment back there, but believe it or not, there was no way to make that work with D.C. guidelines. Something else that should probably change. At the same time, I had a very significant teaching load, much higher than probably was appropriate for an assistant professor. And that's because I love teaching. I've done it my whole life. I literally taught through high school and college and at Johns Hopkins. I was in charge of mentoring all the international students who weren't passing their classes. My job was to get them to pass when I was getting my PhD, which we succeeded in. But my first year at San Francisco, I was teaching a small group lecture course in epidemiology and biostatistics. I got nominated for a teaching award. So the dean calls my department chair and says, we have a problem. You have a faculty member who just got nominated for a teaching award, which, by the way, is the first person in the department ever to have that happen. And he said, well, why is that a problem? He goes, because she has a parking permit. If you teach in that series, you're not allowed to. You're only allowed to do research. And in her series, you can't have a parking permit. Okay. So they said, well, then, okay, we'll take away her parking permit and tell her not to teach. And the dean's like, no. This is a first-year faculty member who just got nominated for a teaching award. We'd be thrilled if she got that 5 years from now. So what we're going to do is change her series. Now, this is my first introduction to the academic personnel system. So for those in the room who know, I was an assistant research epidemiologist. That was my title when I was hired. So I switched over to the adjunct series. That also gave me the opportunity to participate in another UC, very strange set of guidelines called the Health Sciences Compensation Plan. can't do that in the research series, but you can do that in the adjunct series. So I had to start learning all of this, like, why would I want to make this move, and what does this mean? But in the meantime, I was also simultaneously asked to take over the first year curriculum for the entire medical school. I'm 28 years old, I've been teaching for 1 year, and I was asked to take over the first year curriculum for the medical school, which I did, foolishly, probably, but I was in charge of it for the next 8 years. In that length of time, now I'm an adjunct professor, because they moved me because of this teaching award. In that length of time, though, we decided to examine whether we removed honorary or honors programs for the first year of medicine. Remove these kind of gunner pre-meds and get them out of a competitive mindset into just a pass-fail curriculum. So I go before the Academic Senate, okay, my first exposure to the Academic Senate, as a course director in charge of the first year curriculum, and I'm asked to testify about what I think will be the effect of removing honors in the first year of the medical school. And then they call for a vote, and I'm not allowed to vote because I'm not a member of the Academic Senate in the adjunct series, right? I am in charge of the first year curriculum, and I'm not a member of the Senate, so I can't vote on this. But I'm looking around the room at all of us who were there to testify as first year course directors, and there were two people allowed to vote. One was one of my mentors, Virginia Ernster, who I taught with, and the other was Pete Ralston. They were the only two ladder-ranked faculty Senate members out of the entire first-year medical school curriculum. And I'm looking around and going, okay, one male, there's another non-Senate male, but everybody else is a woman. And I had not realized the poignancy of that until that moment. And I turned to Bill Margaretten, who's one of my heroes, and Dean of Academic Affairs, the one who called originally and said she's got parking privileges and she's teaching, change her series. I turned to Bill and I said, something is drastically wrong here. Look around this room. It's all women, non-Senate members, all with clinical responsibilities and no resources to run their courses. So we actually did a study and found out my hypothesis was correct. Bill very kindly brought tons of cakes that were all homemade to this rollout of the results and invited all the course directors and made a commitment from the dean's office to get the women in the Senate and to provide them resources, that you could not be required to teach a course unless your department committed resources to you, like somebody to help you print out the syllabus or curriculum and so forth. So we started making changes, which of course was bad to point out to me that I could bring up something that I thought was a problem and then actually affect change as a result. So simultaneously, I started looking at this now with my new knowledge of reading the Academic Personnel Manual and realized not only were people not in the Senate and not having a voice and not having a vote, but there seemed to be other inequities between men and women. So we launched a study, Amy Levine was part of this, looking at gender equity in salary and promotion for faculty, at least in the School of Medicine. So if a man and a woman started off in the same series at the same time, what happened to them over time in their salaries and their advancement through the ranks and steps of acting? And we found there were women who were full professors making anywhere from $30,000 to $60,000 less a year and lifetime earnings upwards towards $1 million difference, potentially, to men who had the exact same job description. That same wonderful dean, Bill Margaretten, turned around and called in every department chair and gave them the opportunity to justify the differences. And when they couldn't, they had to retroactively make up the difference in salary for those women. There was one man and there were 16 women. One woman got a check for over $780,000. Okay, and she has, I have her permission to say this, she is now the Dean of Academic Affairs. So, Donna Ferreira. Donna was the most discriminated against woman at the University of California, San Francisco, as a pediatric neurologist. So again, more evidence that you can affect change, and if you're proactive and you do it generally in a fairly nice fashion, you might be able to bring it about. So we kept doing these equity studies. We next turned to looking at staff. I'll tell you, faculty is much easier to approach than staff. You only have 9 Senate and non-Senate series really in faculty. You have like 350 titles for staff and something beyond that. Who can you put back together? Who can you not? We spent about 6 years trying to look at all the database issues related to staff salary equity and finally came to the conclusion of several things. One was that we have to come up with a better system, and I know John Kamich is here somewhere. I saw him. There we go. You have to have data warehouses to store the data, and you cannot remove your history of personnel data, or you can't look at any of these issues over time. So I'm very happy to say that now, after 25 years of doing these studies, here at UCOP, we're doing it, finally. And this is not my Senate role. This is just, you know, Mary's pig-headed and stubborn and won't give up on something that I think is really appropriate and important to do. The other thing that happened to me early on that was very significant was Bill Margaretten as dean and Diane Mora, who's dean of women, called me into their office, and their office was a converted closet. And I'm not joking. It was about the size of this part of the table, and it just could fit three chairs. Not even a table in the middle, just three chairs. And they said, they started off the meeting by saying, "You're committing professional suicide." I looked at him and said, "What are you referring to?" And I'm thinking, okay, what thing have I done to piss off the chancellor or the dean lately? You know, because I did a lot of stuff on student rights, and obviously these gender equity issues can get you in trouble and, you know, not make everybody your friend. And they said, "You know, your teaching load is so heavy, and you're still an assistant professor, and you're chairing chancellor's committees, and you're doing too much service work, and you're killing yourself. You will never make associate." And I said, "Well, my research is doing fine. I mean, I'm publishing, I'm getting grants from NIH and everything else." They said, "Yeah, but you need to make it so people know that's what you do. You're known on campus for being an activist and your service work and your teaching, and nobody knows about your research, even if it's known at this national level." So I kept that in mind, but in fact, I didn't change anything I was doing. I just thought, this is what I want to do with my life, and it's important to me, and when I look at where what I want to be doing between 2 and 3 a.m., this is the activities that I want to be doing if I'm not sleeping. And so I'm not, and by the way, that's a barometer I still use. So I didn't change it, but Bill called me back about 2 years later and said, "You know, you really actually have a very balanced portfolio. We need to move you into an academic senate series. On your last review at academic personnel, they recommended an advancement, an acceleration." So moving me up an extra step. He said, "I'd like to counter-propose not being accelerated, but rather being moved over to in-residence." And he goes, "Because we've got to take all this academic personnel experience you've got and use it in the academic senate, and you can't do that if you're not a member of the senate." So we did that. My new department chair agreed to that, moved in. I think at this point I had 3 kids, and I now have 4. And then 3 stepkids, so technically kind of 7, but 3 I don't really have to have primary responsibility for. But, you know, I was kind of becoming this person that people were looking at on campus and saying, "How's she doing it? She has 3 kids." Because most women either had 0 or 1. And if you looked at the junior women, they had 2. That was really decadent that they had 2 kids. And there were 3 of us, well, 3 on campus eventually who had 4 kids. Myself, Patty Robertson, and Bill Goodson. And Bill left the faculty eventually. So we were kind of held up as these oddities of people who thought it was important to have large families or enjoyed it, or in my case, liked the chaos. And so I started having women calling me. "I'm thinking about having another child. What do you think?" What I think really doesn't matter. I'm not going to be getting up in the middle of the night when your child has an ear infection. So, but let me tell you, if you go to 3, you go from one-on-one to zone defense. That's the best analogy I can give you. And the larger there is, the less demands there is on you. The kids start taking care of each other. That's a little bit easier, you know. But I give them my pointers. And the number one is have really exceptionally good child care. Whatever else you spend your money on doesn't really matter, because if you can come to work and not worry about your kids, you will be fine. So I did have a live-in nanny for 12 years, who still has trouble not being my children's nanny, even though it's been 5 years. But she was just exceptionally good, and there was nothing I ever had to worry about with my kids, with her there and so forth. And, you know, she'd do things like, "Why don't I work a little late tonight? You've got a grant due in 2 weeks. Don't worry about it," you know. So she was so much a part of the family that she knew how to do all the backup and watch out for things, too. So while all this was going on, I'm writing grants, which my daughter in kindergarten defined as grants are things that keep mommies away from their children. probably still to this day the best definition I've ever heard of a grant. She was trying to explain that to one of her little friends in the back seat when I said, I can't take you to the park, I gotta get home and finish that grant. Her friend said, what is a grant? Well, grants are things that keep mommies away from their children. So that was one thing, writing grants, running a course, you know, doing a lot of committee work and kind of trying to make this all happen and get home to either nurse a baby or get them dinner or be there for bath time or read a bedtime story or maybe see them in the morning before I left. My husband, who was from Ireland, who knew I had a PhD, was becoming increasingly resentful, that's the nicest way I could put it, about the demands on my time and what my career really needed. Of course, if he'd stuck it out till now, he would have had an easier time, but instead, he left. And what was interesting to me is he left about 2 months after I'd learned, through a series of interviews of women at UCSF, where we were trying to do yet another study to look at the climate for women and men at UC San Francisco. I had found in doing these interviews that there was not a single senior faculty woman who was married to either one, her original partner, or still married. None of them. Zero. It was a pretty disturbing finding, and when we looked at this and said, what does it take? What are the demands of your career that lead you to be able to accomplish this? And talking to these women and finding out if they'd gotten remarried, they married another UCSF faculty member, because I was the only person they could find who was accepting of that lifestyle. So it was about 2 months after we finished that my husband walked in and said, I'm really unhappy, I'm moving out, I want a divorce, and then he walked back out of the room. And I just sat there stunned. I had a 2-year-old, a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 10-year-old. And I live in Manny still, thank God. So I had to reevaluate my life and my priorities. As it ended up, I'm much happier. He's still unhappy. And I don't have to ask anybody if I can put braces on the kids' teeth or put them in a summer school enrichment program. It's really nice, actually. But what was interesting to that was deciding, what did I want to do? How did I want to spend that time between 2 and 3 a.m.? And I kind of came to the conclusion sleep was getting more important. So I looked at what I was doing, what I was spending my time in at San Francisco, and thought, you know, I've been a teacher, I've been a course director for 15 years. I've done a great job. We're revamping the entire curriculum. It's probably a good idea to let that go. I guess I didn't explain it well enough to my kids, because the next spring, I'm at my son's Little League game, and I don't have my laptop on my lap. And I taught in the spring, which meant I would try to get to his games, but I was always writing a midterm or revamping a problem set or doing something. So he comes up to me after the game and he goes, Mommy, your laptop's not with you. And I go, no. And he goes, are you still working? I said, well, no, I gave up being a course director. So now my spring is not as difficult as it used to be. I should have explained that better to them. And then, you know, it's this strange thing where if you go from 100 hours a week down to about 80, and you go, wow, that was really good. I like this. Then you start going, God, maybe I can decrease it a little bit more. So I looked at what I was doing in terms of my research. I'm like, this is insane to be trying to be internationally and nationally recognized in two different fields. This is just not a viable option. So I gave up being director of this practice-based research network. I mentored people, got them able to take it over, and they took it over, and I just stuck to my reproductive health and infertility research. And that has encompassed, what I did in that was create a cohort of 52,000 women who've undergone infertility treatment in the state of California sometime between 1965 and 1998. All HIPAA compliant for those people in the room who care. And we track them over time to see what their health outcomes are and if they conceive or don't conceive and so forth, how well their children do and what their health outcomes are too. And that is still critically important to me, and I'm still willing to be up in the middle of the night to do that work. And as I said, I still think that's one of my best barometers. But in the meantime, I continue to be interested in all these equity issues, all the issues for women. We're continuing to do these climate studies. And out of that, developed a faculty mentoring program and a corollary for graduate students and postdocs for all faculty at UCSF, and Larry Fitz was here a moment ago. Larry's the one who actually called me and said, I want you to create a faculty mentoring program for the schools and the entire campus. And I said, this was 2 weeks after my husband had moved out, and I said, if you give me more time, I'm happy to do it, but I can't do it right now. Larry's just like, I want you to do it. You just take however much time you need. And 2 years later, I had it done. But that, for me, is pretty slow. But we could address the issues going on for women on the campus. Why were they not having balance between their family life and their work life? What were we doing wrong? And in addition to Bill Margaret, who by this time was getting ready to retire, Reg Kelly came along. And Reg had been a single dad. And Reg turned to me and he goes, you know what one of the real problems is for the staff? If your kids are in a daycare center where they charge you 5 a minute when you're late, he goes, you can't afford to park 4 blocks away from Parnassus and stay at work until the last minute and then be 15 minutes late every day picking up your kid. He goes, can't we restructure the parking garage so we give preferential parking to single parents who have their kids in daycare? And I'm like, Reg, you're vice chancellor. If you can, but yes, let's do it. So we, but then how do you identify those people, or how do they self-identify? But we started to come up with much more creative ideas about how you could actually balance your life. Like, what are the simple, and I'll use even the word stupid, little things that make life difficult for all of us? So we started to address that, and one of them was that faculty came to San Francisco. They never knew where to go to get food. Who knew the answers to any questions you had? So we started through the Chancellor's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women to create websites, to create resources, to put parental leave policies on there. One of my favorite other stories was when I asked for my first maternity leave, and this was actually to adopt my oldest daughter. My department chair said, I think 8 weeks is really, really too much time for an adoption. You haven't gone through a pregnancy or anything else. Well, I've since had 3 pregnancies and births. Believe me, adoption is much more difficult because you go from 150 miles an hour down to zero overnight, which is very different from pregnancy adjusting you to that over time. But he said, I'm going to talk to the dean's office. Well, he calls the dean's office. He doesn't tell him it's for me, right? And he gives 3 different people to refer him back and say, you know, Mary Krogan has developed all the parental leave policies. So he was kind of stuck in the end. He said, 3 for 3 people referred me back to you. And then I tried to tell him it's your parental leave. And they said, well, still, whatever she's asking for is probably correct. But we had to work very hard at the system-wide level to get those policies maintained, which also put me back in the academic personnel manual. So when I became an in-residence faculty member, now I'm in the Senate, yet another opportunity to make change. So I went on the Committee on Academic Personnel and served there for 3 years, was vice chair and so forth. Asked to serve as, they asked me to serve as the representative to the system-wide committee, so the University Committee on Academic Personnel that meets usually upstairs on the 11th floor. So I served on UCAP, became vice chair of UCAP, and then chair. And when you're chair, you serve on the Academic Council, which is the executive body of the system-wide Academic Senate. From there, was asked to run for the office of vice chair and elected by the Academic Council to become vice chair, and then now this year, serve as chair of it. So it's this weird twist of fate, right? You look back at what I was doing 25 years ago where I was angry and when I saw women faculty not getting the resources they needed to teach and not having a voice in the governance of the curriculum, went on to look at all the equity studies there, became more and more interested in academic personnel issues, and then now actually I'm at a point to be able to affect change. The frustrating part is we're only now looking at academic senate membership or qualifications or rights and privileges for non-Senate members. So something that I personally was affected by for 10 years, we're only now starting to re-examine. And Steve knows this because the Cooperative Extension Specialists are yet another one of those groups that gets disadvantaged in addition to the health science faculty. So kind of what's important out of all of that in UC, I think one aspect is that UC gave me the opportunity to do it. I think it's critical that this system has flexibilities that aren't accommodated by other universities. And never once did somebody come to me and say, you can't do that, or you're going to lose your job over this. I mean, there was the professional suicide, but that was actually 2 colleagues trying to help me see that my next step could be difficult if I didn't change what I was doing. And I've done a lot of consulting at other universities, Texas, Penn, USC, Stanford, and so forth. And I don't see that kind of support. I don't see that kind of flexibility. I see a lot of traditions that are very ingrained, and this is how we've done it for 100 years, and no, we can't change. We can't even consider changing. which makes it all actually more critical that Jack was able to make a change at Hopkins. I just can't even imagine having that fortitude at that institution. So it's made me stay here. I gave up what would have been a very lucrative position with my kids' tuition covered at Stanford. Four kids, you can imagine, and they would have taken in the three stepkids with tuition remission at Stanford. That was a little tough to say no. But I thought, you know, I don't see those opportunities at Stanford. I don't see the same opportunities that UC affords women, and in particular affords all faculty to be able to affect change. And the other thing that I think was important was the mentoring and the people I've really had in my life who helped guide me, might say, you know, you're welcome to do this, but you should also consider this. And so I think the other aspect that's been really important is being able to turn around and do that for other people. Whether it's you just make an introduction, you know who you should really talk to is so-and-so, they might be able to help you out. And of course, before that person even reaches them, you've already sent them an email and said, you should be hearing from so-and-so, and, you know, here's how incredible this person is, and this is why I referred them to you. You know, be proactive about it. But step out of your own world, your own life, and see what you can do to help others. I've had, in 22 years of research, well over 100 staff, you know, between research assistants, study coordinators, programmers, and so forth. And every one of them, well, most, if they were really term staff, they usually stayed with me for 10 or 12 years. If they were research assistant staff, we were always trying to hire people who were looking to advance themselves to the next stage. So I have a huge group, predominantly women, I must admit, because when you're interviewing women or you're doing body measurements, it's pretty difficult to actually hire young men to have women stripped down and take, you know, body mass index measurements and so forth. But predominantly women who then went on to vet school, law school, med school, PhD programs. And I think that kind of mentoring is important too, looking at what you can do to help with others and advance their careers and not just your own. So the couple pieces of advice is, you know, never close the door. Always think about what might be the next opportunity. I'm not a huge fan of change and risk. I live a mile from the house I grew up in. My kids go to the elementary school and are still there with my third grade teacher. So I say this with the fact that I'm not a big fan of having change, and yet you can still affect change. And you can make things better for others, and you can make things better for yourself as a result, too. But always look for where you can do that. I've taken risks multiple times. One time, which I wouldn't have called a risk, actually, but it appeared to be, where I was pregnant with my fourth child, and I hadn't told anybody in my department yet, but I was almost killed in a plane wreck when I was about 12 weeks pregnant with her. And so my department chair came in the next day, and he goes, God, you look pale, you still look shaken, you do not look good. And I'm like, I'm not. And he said, you know, lay down, because your blood pressure is too low. And then all of a sudden his face looks at me and goes, your blood pressure always drops when you're pregnant. Are you pregnant? And I just looked at him, I go, yes. And he stands up and he closes the door and he goes, I'm serious, lay on the floor, because he goes, you have no color and you look too shaky and all that. Well, it's just from this plane crash the day before. And he closes the door and he said, so when you take maternity leave this time? And I go, yeah. I want you to actually stay home. I don't want you to just bring the baby to work every day. I can't tell the difference between when you're on maternity leave and when you're not. I said, when I'm on maternity leave, I wear jeans. When I'm not on maternity leave, I know that's the signal. And he goes, but I want you from then on to go home and have dinner with your family at night. I don't want to see you here past 7 p.m. I want to see you take time to be with this kid because your career is on track and you're fine and you need to start devoting more time to your family. And I just burst into tears. Of course, I was totally hormonal too. But I burst into tears and I said, there's probably not another woman faculty member in this entire university who would hear their department chair say, slow down. Spend time with your family. You're doing fine in your career. So Jack Rodnick is his name. He unfortunately died 3 years ago. But Jack set the tone for, unfortunately, a standard that no other department chair has ever met since. And in medical schools, you're incredibly dependent on your department chairs. They're pretty put there by national searches, they serve for 10, 15, 20 years. They're not faculty members who rotate through every 3 to 5 years. So it's a very different position. But his mentorship, the mentorship of my first department chair in that department, who the first week on the job said, what are your career goals? Where do you want to be in 5 to 10 years? And how can I help you get there? I mean, what a standard to set. You know, and this is when I'm an assistant research epidemiologist who can't have a parking permit, right? And he's saying to me, what are your career goals and how can I help you get there? So I just feel like I've been blessed. I have been incredibly fortunate. I've had incredible mentorship through my life. I've tried to turn around and do that for others. And I would just ask that of all of you, too. You know, see what you can do to reach out to other people and help them with their career development. So it's what we do on the President's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women. I'm not there as Senate Chair. In fact, I kind of ticked off some people in the Senate when I said I'm going to do this. And I said, I'm there because it was 10 years on the Chancellor's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women at San Francisco. And we brought about change, and it's important to do it here within UCO. So it's been an honor and a privilege to get to do that. But I'm happy to entertain questions. We've got about 5-10 minutes. Is that about right? So fire at me. If you can tell, I'll tell you anything. So, not a problem. You got any, Amy? You know me too well.
I know.
Amy lived through all 4 pregnancies, serving on CACSA.
The husband
divorce. The husband divorce. Yeah.
Would you want to talk a little bit about what may be the future for you? Your tenure ends here.
Yeah. The chair's an elected position, so I'm only here until September 1st. And I've loved it. And I took this in part because, like I said, I've always done this kind of service aspect. And my department chair and division chief were like, why don't you just do this and do it full time and see if you love it or you hate it? Because that's what tends to happen with academic senate chairs. They either find out they love it and they want to continue, or they hate it and they never want to do administration ever again in their entire life. So I fall in the camp of having loved it. So I am looking for opportunities, whether it's San Francisco or elsewhere in the UC system. I really feel like UC is my home. So I would love to do something after this. Yeah, definitely. I don't want to be in the grants keep their kids away from their mommy's mode any longer, so I have to figure out what I am going to do, next steps. And, you know, worked a lot, obviously, in academic personnel issues, worked a lot in curriculum development, all kinds of different aspects of things. So we'll see. We'll see what the opportunities are. But I'd like to stay in the UC family. Yeah. Yes.
Mary, you're just an outstanding role model for all of us, and I can see why people gravitated towards you and why they offered you your mentors. But for most of the other people, like us, how do you find a mentor, and what do you look for in somebody?
You know what? I actually have a whole PowerPoint on that. So sorry. The problem with having developed the faculty mentoring program that now actually Penn has, you know, launched theirs and proven to be one of the most successful in the nation and so forth from what I gave them. I'm happy to actually do a little meantime talk on that. That'd be fine. But the bottom line is you identify what your needs are. So is it, you know, career development, and who are people you admire, and you approach them and say, I admire what you've accomplished, or you're doing the kind of work I'd like to be doing in 15 years. Would you meet with me every 6 months? Come up with something realistic and not too onerous, because they're more likely to say yes. And then it likely will develop into something that becomes more frequent and useful, too. But finding somebody who meets your needs. So it might be career development. It might be, here, see if this was an academic audience, I'd be saying, you know, your service commitments, your research, your teaching, or whatever. So what specific aspects of your job are you looking for? And if it's somebody you admire and how they handle their personal life or how they deal with conflict, those are rare people to find and hang on to them if you find them. Like you see somebody who handles conflict within your office extremely well, and you say, you know, I have a situation over here and I'd like to get your advice on it or your insights. Those can be incredibly helpful people. And you actually never know who's going to end up in a mentoring role. That first equity study I did, there was another assistant professor, Nola Hilton, who I was working with at the time. And Nola and I set up a peer mentoring program because we were both coming up for associate. And we both knew we were spending way too much time doing this other women's stuff, as they said, and not enough time getting our papers out. So once a month, we met at a restaurant that actually the dean, Bill Margaretten, ate lunch at every single day. And it was miles away from campus. Bill went there to get away from the rest of us. But we thought having his aura was good. So we went to Bill's restaurant called Ella's in San Francisco once a month, and we had to have something to hand to the other person. Didn't have to be in final form, but I had to have a draft manuscript or a draft grant or something that was really concrete and academic. Now, she's a physicist. She does nuclear radiographic imaging for breast cancer. I can't read anything she writes. She can't read anything I write. But having a deadline every month was incredibly productive because I had somebody else I had to answer to. Otherwise, you know, your own stuff constantly gets pushed off. Everybody else's deadlines push yours. You don't schedule enough time to get it done. So that helps. So I actually put mentoring through the whole aspect. And when we created the faculty mentoring program at UCSF, and I had to go to Mike Bishop as chancellor to get his buy-in and his money to support it, and he said, well, am I going to have a mentor? And I said, yes. I've actually lined up 6 other chancellors, 2 within the UC system and 4 outside the UC system, and you're going to have a kitchen cabinet of mentors. I said, because you need mentoring through your whole life. It's not just assistant professors. I mean, we change jobs. We change job descriptions. We do different things. It's not like what you had before is still going to work. You need new people. Don't have to give up the old ones necessarily, but you need new ones.
Mary?
Yeah.
Since this is like the first inaugural event for the President's Advisory Council on the Status of Women, if you could just give us 2 minutes about how it developed in San Francisco and where you think we could get.
God, a million places you could go. Actually, Amy, you're going to have to help me on the history. You helped write it with Barbara. We actually have a publication on the history of the committee. Slow Steps to Change, that's right. And you, if you read it, you'll have to hear me all over again because I'm part of the interviews that they did for that. But it really was Virginia Olson the first chair, as I recall?
Marion Nessel
was, that's right. Nutritionist who's since gone to New York and been with the FDA and everything else. But it began as women seeing issues for women on campus and trying to find it and create a support network. And to this day, that is actually still a major role of that committee. I mean, who I would have to name as mentors, many of them are those women on that committee who helped see me through, you know, would give me advice, started telling me about retirement programs when I was 30 years old and could have cared less, but said, no, you want to hit Professor Step 6 by the time you retire because it's a huge bump in pay for retirement. I wouldn't have been paying attention to that, you know. So just even the little tidbits of advice that were possible in that group of women, and there's still some of the people I'm closest to, Amy being one of them. But we addressed, you know, as I said, the staff and faculty equity, staff promotion issues. We wrote a book called Getting There From Here, which is now on the web. We finally threw away all the paper copies because nobody requested anymore. We did huge numbers of policy changes, actually the parental leave policies, post-ops getting parental leave, trying to get equity regardless of your funding source on that, what we call the tampon committee, and then my apologies to those people who think that's offensive, but you could never find a tampon machine in San Francisco. And so we just hounded the facilities management people for about a year and said, you'll check these machines, you'll make sure they work, that they don't eat up your money, and they actually give you a product when you pay for it. And they're right on it now. You can find them anywhere, and if there's not one in that bathroom, it tells you what gift shop to find. So the tampon committee was extremely effective. The other that's been effective was breastfeeding, the breast pump group, which was another kind of concrete thing too, to provide rooms for breast pumps for women. When I was chairing CAPSAW, we were remodeling Laurel Heights to move faculty and staff in there. And every week I'd go to look at the blueprints, and the breast pump room was removed. And I'd remind them that they needed to put it back in, and then it would be removed, and then it would put back in. And finally, I put a red crayon circle. I really pissed off the architect. I put a big red crayon circle around it and said, do not touch. So they kept the breast pump room in. Then they wouldn't furnish it. I got the electrical outlet, I got it plumbed for the sink so you could wash the equipment, but I could not get furniture in there. And I was complaining to Irene Agnos, actually at the Center for Gender Equity one night, and I was there for some reception for something you were doing, Amy. And I turned to Irene and I said, you can't believe it, the room's there, the door, there's a lock on the door, but there's no furniture. Well, she was going to some Haas family event that night, and I get a call the next day. We have a, like, $6,000 leather wingback chair, walnut burl table, and the sink, which was, like, this beautiful Kohler sink. I'm like, okay, great, now I've got to fold everything. You know? But the Haas family was just, Irene just went to them and said, come on, just donate this, you know? And they went and got really nice furniture and donated it for the rooms, you know? And so there's things where you just got to stay determined and stubborn. But you can bring things about. So we went all the way from the most mundane, Cheryl, up to the highest levels. Tons of faculty and staff development courses. Always did that. Always did luncheons with keynote speakers coming in from all over the world, actually. Looking at international women's health issues, looking at leadership development. We've done tons of faculty development courses where we bring in all the junior women faculty, invite all of them. By the way, sometimes there's legalities on you have to invite them in too, but other times there aren't, and that's always an issue on when it's a women's committee. But having the faculty development courses with the most junior women and postdocs invited, and then the senior women there to meet with them in small groups at little round tables, again, makes all those mentoring connections for everybody. Diversity issues, I've looked at that. What can we do to promote diversity, get increased diversity, whether it's pipeline, retention, recruitment, all of that. I mean, I don't know, hundreds of projects over 35, 40 years now for that. You do. You do. And I think really, you know, a way to start here, and I'm sorry, I'm an epidemiologist, so this is always my first tack, is start surveying the men and women in the building and finding out what are your needs. And I think that's a good way to start. And Amy's going to now speak to having done that.
I already have information I could share with the committee, but it's now 2 years old. So I know UCLP has gone through a couple of changes in the past few years.
Anybody still here? But I think that's a really good place to start. So taking that data and then seeing what could we do? What are the action steps that are associated with those needs and those problems? I think that makes a huge difference, a really huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Actually, we have one of those committees too, Lonnie. I think it's a different one.
Resources. I've been working in facilities on a similar matter.
We call it the resources.
Yeah.
We're on it, but the people in charge of refilling the machines keep leaving.
Yeah.
Or getting
laid off or something like that. Yeah, it's a trick. Other questions in the last remaining minute or two?
Well, we do have a drawing to conduct. So, let's thank Mary. I'd like to add our thanks not just for today, but for your ongoing inspiration to all of us and to the committee on the status of women in particular. You can't imagine how wonderful it's been to have our inaugural year with Mary on the committee.
It's been fun.
We've really kept it going.
And maybe Susan, just so the others would know, if you can have the other folks that are on the committee stand. I mean, a lot of us are standing already, but there's quite a few women here that are on your committee, and maybe you should know who they are.
Raise your hand.
Nice idea.
Raise your hand.
So this is who we are, and there's... And the list is on the website, which was in all of the information that was sent out.
It is. And now it is my very great pleasure to turn the drawing over to Ms. Rosemary Jensen.
I was selected as the person to draw from the people who entered. Was that the one who wants to enter for their name?